Blog Talk Radio. Firefly Willows LIVE presents The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring your hosts, Heisey Lutmers and Charlie Harrington.
To the show. This is High C, and you're listening to the Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist. And I'm joined by my co-host, Charlie Harrington. And hopefully you enjoyed that special little intro that we did for the month of October, that month of spookiness and darkness and all things scary. And so that was just a special little intro that we put together that hopefully you enjoyed. Just want to do a little housekeeping to let you know that you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheAmethystOracle. We're always happy to have you like the page, comment on the shows, feel free to continue the conversations that we might have here. If you have some insights or things, or if you pull cards for things we might do, we're always happy to hear what came up for you, what you thought, what your interpretations of something were on the show. You can also, if you would like a reading during the show this evening, you can call in or Skype in. You can Skype in from the show page, or you can call in at 646-716-5510. As I said, my name is High C, And I will say hello and good evening to my co-host, Charlie.
Good evening, Hi C. How are you doing?
I was just listening to
Rod Serling earlier, and it made me question the mortal coil I'm so attached to. So thank you for that and that opening.
Well, I'm glad that I could take you to places that you might not normally go to.
That's sort of your what you're known for, actually, I think. But anyway, good to be here. That's right. Say no more. It's a very good month to be a fortune teller. This is one of those times of the year when everyone wants their tarot reading done, and a lot of well-minded readers take this opportunity to show that tarot doesn't need to be spooky or disturbing in any way. But, you know, hey,
where's the fun in that? Scary. That's right. We're going to make it spooky and scary. We're reclaiming it, you know, just like people do with words.
Yes, we're reclaiming the horror film dignity of tarot.
That's right.
To go out there, listeners, and tell someone that they're turning into a werewolf, you know.
So. To be very
Doom.
Afraid.
Doom all around, I say.
That's right. And speaking of other readers, we had the opportunity and good fortune to be asked to be presenters at a monthly gathering, shall we say, called WooFest in San Francisco. And do you want to let people know what WooFest is? Well, yes, but do you want to let people know what WooFest is?
Yes, WooFest is a gathering that takes place once a month, organized by the Tarot Media Company, and in their space at Mission Alchemy, a lot of spiritual folks get together, and there's usually someone giving a presentation on a particular topic for part of the evening. And I know the intention definitely was that people from all sorts of different varietals of woo could talk, but largely tarot readers tend to take over the joint, as we are wont to. But there have been presentations about astrology or shamanism there as well, but none were quite so stupendous as the Amethyst Oracle hosting WooFest. We talked about the queerest techniques we had ever experienced, and then we forced all of the participants to take part in trying those techniques.
That's right.
So it was, and fun had by all.
For those that were not there, one of the things you missed was glutomancy.
Yes, glutomancy, the sacred art. Well, do you want to explain that one?
Well, I'm just going to let people ponder what that is and realize they better make sure that they're at our next presentation, because they have no idea what they're missing out on being able to participate in. So we will leave it with that. We might call it glutomancy. We could call it gluteus maximancy.
Right. Root chakra divinatory practices.
That's right.
Oh, and what did I call it? Astrology. Didn't everyone think that was a funny thing when I said that? Didn't.
I'm sure. I'm sure you perceived everyone did think it was
funny. Yes.
But undoubtedly, we brought the woo along with the queer.
Yes. We'd be bringing the woo.
And this evening, we thought we would also tap into that theme just a little bit and do what are called wisdom readings, which I'm not sure if they were invented by Rachel Pollack, but I know that she has really popularized it and developed the theme of that. And wisdom readings are basically where you ask these big questions and then allow the tarot to give you insight or information or enlightenment about those things, where there is no right or wrong. It's just to lead you down a path, take you on that fool's journey into the wisdom of that big question. So we decided to do a couple of those for this month because of the theme. And what might that be, Charlie Harrington?
Spooky, evil, death and destruction and doom. So we looked at two cards that tend to terrify for some alliteration there. But the death card and the devil, because where a tarot reader, you know, might be more afraid of the tower, of the three of swords, the general populace, the great unwashed, have been taught by B-films to fear the death, death and the devil. And then along came this sort of, you know, again, well-meaning appropriateness, and people have been saying, no, you know, death is a new beginning. The devil is all about our inner, you know, conflict with our inner demons, maybe our tendency towards, you know, inappropriate levels of addiction. But, you know, it's also important to express that devil shadow self, and, you know, so we're here to bring it back, to drag it back into the chains. Oh, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but I also think that approaching them as a wisdom reading, death and the devil are also two very big, almost universal to some extent, although I realize there's cultures that don't have the devil. Please keep your hate mail about my cultural insensitivities. But, you know, death and the devil are much bigger than just two cards in the deck. And so I think that doing wisdom readings around that allows us also a little bit of insight into the bigger concepts of death.
Yes.
And the devil.
And the devil.
Besides just the cards themselves.
I agree. And a lot of people will do wisdom readings about, you know, what is God? You know, what are the soul? What does it mean to be a woman? You know, things that they're exploring with the cards and in a sort of more of a philosophical way rather than sort of a trying to decipher the actual, you know, agreed upon truth. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
Okay.
So we divvied up the two, death and the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And you came along with what?
Death.
So
I'm looking at death.
Death is your companion. Death is your companion this evening.
Yes, death. And so the thought was to pull a card. One technique people have is sort of to pull a card and just maybe just that one card to explore the concept. And so I pulled from the Ghosts and Spirits Tarot by Lisa Hunt. It was published, I believe, last year, and it has her beautiful artwork, but each card represents a different spirit or ghost from different legends all across the planet. And I wasn't sure what would come up, and I was a little worried it might be too specific. But I'm very excited. So Death, are you ready for this? Death is the Ace of Wands. And in this deck, the Ace of Wands is a Will of the Wisp, or Will-O-Wisp, which it's that idea of when you're out in maybe usually like a swampy area or at night, you will see a glowing light in the distance that will draw you towards it. And so people think it's like swamp gas or something like that. There's a lot of theories about what is a will-o-wisp. Traditional Eastern folklore, East European folklore, these are the souls of dead children that are there to lure you into the forest where you will come to a bad end. But if you saw the film Brave by Pixar last year, there's a much more benign will-o-wisp series of characters that are leading Merida, the princess, towards her fate, as she describes it. So I thought about that. I was like, okay, what does this mean? Because you have to, like, come back to the original question, what is death? And then what in the tarot is the Ace of Wands? And also in this deck, what is the Will of the Wisp? So you're juggling all of those things. And it was interesting for me, death, I often fight against the tendency for people to be too light about the concept of death in tarot and also in life. When people say, oh, well, you know, let's start with tarot. In the tarot, it just becomes a new beginning. It's so great. It's so wonderful. You know, something has ended and you get to start over fresh. And some people in life are like, oh, you know, death. Why worry about death? You know, it's inevitable and it's not a problem and it's probably just fine. And I tend to have a lot more trepidation around the concept of physical death. So I was excited by this card because it's letting me know that death is a strange new beginning. To me, the Ace of Wands is, all of the aces are the most abstract version of that element. So it's a very amorphous concept of fire, of that kind of life force and passion. And death allows you to be drawn into something else. We would be very excited remaining in our ego. I know I would. For all eternity being ourselves. There's all sorts of fiction and about what happens to people who seek after immortality. There's also Howard Hughes, I guess. And the Will-O-Wisp, the Ace of Wands card here tells me that death, because it is ambiguous, that we can't really know what's on the other side of that, but it calls to us at the end and allows us to explore something that's farther away. And I thought that was an interesting card to pull for this. If it had been too saccharine, you know, if it was, oh, it's the Three of Cups, I might not have known what to do with that. But the Ace of Wands, to me, was an interesting death card. It is a new beginning, but it's a strange new beginning. An ace, it's so undeveloped. And with that Will-O-Wisp, you're being pulled into another world. You're leaving behind what is comfortable, what is known, what is secure, which is sort of that like idea of being taken out of civilization and into the forest. So death is your guide into the mysteries and the beyond.
I found it.
But what do you think of that?
Well, I found it kind of funny that, you know, usually people think of death in terms of, you know, darkness or, you know, when you die, then you go into the dark or the underworld or all those kind of things. And yet you really pulled a card that kind of traditionally would represent the almost essence and ultimate aspect of light with the Ace of Wands, because it's like the essence of fire,
yes,
which is so opposite of darkness. But maybe that Ace of Wands is that light at the end of the tunnel that we, you know,
go into the light,
go to. Exactly, exactly. And I dare say it did come up to also, to me anyway, kind of indicate some of the things that we think that maybe people have gotten a little too carried away with seeing the death card as. But there's a lot of aspects about rebirth and something new happening. Because like Ace of Wands to me is kind of like the Big Bang. So it's kind of that beginning of something new. So death is kind of that rebirth or that stepping, that transformation by fire aspect of moving into something new. Still unformed, like you were saying, you know, it's this kind of amorphous thing, but it still is that spark of creation is what the Ace of Wands often is for me. And so if that's what death is, then it is kind of that spark of creation of the next stage, the next evolution, the next aspect of our soul's journey, whatever. And I know I'm probably waxing poetic in things that you bristle at that tarot readers deal with or go to for the death card.
No, what I loved about this is it helped me get over my own ego. Whenever you have a position on anything in tarot and you're so staunch about it, like I am about, oh, there's those, you know, silly people and their white lights and angel wings with the death, you know, death is a very... Well, if I'm that serious about it, if I'm taking myself that seriously about the death card, then I need to lighten up. And I love that this kind of helped me do that. I was the Will-O-Wisp is such like a little light, and it's very soft, and it's, you know, it's very... It's drawing me away from my egotistical need to have a very strong position on something in the tarot, you know, that I, and pulling me away. And it's you know, sometimes, I don't know, if you ask the tarot, I don't know, something big, you want a definite answer, like, is there a life after death, you know, like, or is it the end, you know, this is saying, no, it's a beginning, you know, this is,
right.
This is a, you know, undeniably.
But I think that's one of the power, one of the big, you know, powerful aspects of the wisdom readings is it can sometimes challenge your ego. It does often challenge your long-held beliefs or perceptions or interpretations of something. And it also helps to start expanding your way of thinking about something because we can get a little bit trapped or lost in our little bubble of how
musty
we think
in there.
About it. You know, so
and it adds
it,
new
it
words
would serve,
to your little
it would
bag
serve,
of tricks.
It would serve Fox News and their viewers well to do some wisdom readings, expand their bubble a little bit.
What is news? What should
well, I should just say that their Fox News' entertainment programming that they provide for their viewers.
So what you were talking about, doing a wisdom reading is not the sort of just pulling a card and trying to be as clever as possible about coming to the answer that you were hoping for or that you believe by finding the little part of the meaning of that card that fits and going, aha, I'm so clever. I've seen people do that with wisdom readings and they kind of, that's not what this is for. You know, if you really are asking, be kind of open to that. So I liked that for me, death, this person in the image, they're, you know, in a dark forest, and they're surrounded by these dark trees and spooky, and that's telling me that the idea of death is very, very wrapped up in the unknown and the idea of being a victim, you know, and helpless. But there's a path out. There's a way out, Starshine, and it's a path of these lights that are appearing before the person. So. I was comforted by that.
And I think something you said when you were saying, you know, trying to be all clever and that kind of thing, wisdom readings are sometimes about setting your ego aside and allowing the cards to be more clever than you think you are. Because they will often give you something that's not quite what you expected or thought, and yet that can be the beauty and the fun of it if you actually will allow for that rather than trying to twist it around to what you expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So now shall we move through death?
Something more infernal.
See who may await us on the other side.
Yeah.
Sometimes
well,
called the devil.
Definitely. The natural progression from us will be from death to the devil, I think.
That's right. And so I approach this with the question of who or what is the devil? And I shuffled the deck 6 times. I then cut the deck 6 times. And then I chose the 6th card. So you see what I did there? 6-6 for the devil.
Look at you, Damien.
I know. I think I'm so clever.
No, I think that was, I mean, if you think about it, if you're going to have some fun with this, like, if you're going to ask about the devil, you really must summon him, you know, like, so it seems like you did kind of a mini summoning ritual there, you know, all you needed was like a sacrificed chicken at a crossroads. And
that's right. And really isn't the devil and the 666 thing. 666 thing, just superstition. It's not like I said something, you know, real and dangerous like Beetlejuice 3 times. I mean, I was just
there. We go
having fun with
Bloody Mary.
I wasn't taking risks, you know, with those things.
That's right.
So the card.
Your records backwards.
Yes. Didn't you hear them in the intro?
That's right.
And so the card that came up for who or what is the devil was the 9 of Swords reversed. Oh, I should tell you, I'm using the Necronomicon Tarot by Donald Tyson, who also, the Tarot is part 3 of a trilogy of works that he did, and one was a book called Necronomicon, The Journey of Alzrahed, or whatever that guy's name is that wrote it.
Hazred.
Al-Hazred.
Abdul Al-Hazred.
And then the second book is The Journal or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's told from the perspective of the author. And then the tarot is the third in that aspect. So it's the Necronomicon tarot that I've chosen to use this evening because of our theme.
Love it.
So the Nine of Swords reversed came up. And, you know, when I first saw this, my thought was, because oftentimes you'll hear this card described as upright anyway, as sorrow, and sometimes it's insomnia because like the original image is the woman who's sitting up in bed and looks like she can't sleep or whatever. In this deck, it's a man and a woman whose backs are facing each other, and it looks as if they've had an argument, so they've kind of turned away from each other, and it's kind of that after the argument, and now I'm just going to turn around and stew in my anger kind of thing. So the reversal for me, if I thought about like the insomnia aspect and overthinking things to the point that I can't sleep, the reversal of it oftentimes for me means that somebody is sleeping. Here, there could be two aspects, because one, I could see it where the devil is something that actually exists or comes to us in the sleep realm or in the nightmare realm. And therefore isn't actually something that's in the everyday world, but is something that we're summoning from a deeper place or from another realm rather than something that exists right in front of us. So with it being the suit of swords, it has to say, you know, is the devil something that is just in our head versus something that is real? Have we thought it enough to create thought forms that have become a reality for people, and therefore the devil becomes real because there are enough thought forms giving it substance versus it being something that actually exists. I did find it interesting that oftentimes the Nine of Swords upright is considered like sorrow and despair, and it tends to be a very negatively viewed card for a lot of people. And the reversal almost seems to say that the devil isn't as bad as you think. So there may actually be benefit in challenging yourself to develop a relationship with the devil, to be friends with the devil, because appearances may be deceiving, but these appearances may be deceiving in the sense that what we perceive or think are bad or we want to stay away from may not be as bad as we think once we get to know it or start working with it or develop a relationship with it in some way. And so some people will stay up at night afraid of, you know, the evil in the world or something is out to get them or the boogeyman that might come. But the reversal says, but if you just develop that relationship, then you can actually go to sleep. And you'll be okay because you'll be encountering and dealing with that aspect of things in the realm where it exists. But then when you wake up, you get to leave it in that realm and do whatever it is that you've learned from that or taken from that in your waking life, rather than it being something that is somehow controlling and making your waking life bad.
I love it. It's the Nine of Swords came up for me when I did a wisdom reading about what is the value of faith. And the question, the part of the reading that was, what is the value of faith, was the Nine of Swords. And that was very startling, and I had to spend a lot of time thinking about that. But it was the idea for me of struggle eventually, like the Nine of Swords represented, you know, the value of faith was that it is struggle in its work. So for me, that reversing that would be the devil is the guy saying, lighten up. Like, this, why agonize? Why worry? It's sort of that
right.
Playful devil kind of, or, you know.
And I think oftentimes the devil card in the tarot gets seen as the shadow side, can be seen as, like you said, vices, addictions, the conditioning that we have in terms of the things we fall into that aren't necessarily healthy or good, or we fall into supposed to's and should's, so we give power away and we're trying to fit in and be what we think everybody wants us to be rather than being ourselves. And reversing the Nine of Swords could say to that if we, well, first of all, the number nine for me is about patterns. And so when it reverses, it says that we're recognizing the pattern and it's time to start doing something to break or change the habit or pattern so it doesn't keep repeating. And so this to me would show us that the devil is not something that has control over us, but is something that we can actually control. Here, because of the Necronomicon and things, it started to make me think of Goetia or Goetia, however you say it, mm-hmm. Which tends to be a magical tradition or approach to literally summoning demons, but keeping them under control to do your bidding for something very specific. And the Nine of Swords reversed to me kind of said the same thing, that the devil is something we can actually develop that relationship with and use to beneficial purposes if we stop overthinking it to the point that we've convinced ourselves we should be scared of it, that it's something bad, and actually start to see it and work with it for what it is and accept that so that we don't fall into the pattern of always saying either the devil made me do it, which is the excuse we'll use, versus mm-hmm. wake up and take responsibility. But also to see that the devil is actually something that is there not so much to inflict despair and sorrow on us, which would be more of the upright, but is there to actually partner with us if we're able to come to the devil in some ways on the devil's terms. But that just to me is understanding who the devil is, how the devil operates, and knowing when it's appropriate to work with that and when it's not. Therefore, there's not a reason to be afraid of it.
And it's interesting, in that particular deck, the Necronomicon, the couple, their story throughout the Swords suit is sort of kind of a Bonnie and Clyde story. They have kind of a violent existence, but they're partners together. And the Nine of Swords represents, in for them, the point at which their partnership kind of breaks down. And the last card shows the man in the ten shows the man being executed. So it's sort of like the devil. If we're reversing this, if we're reversing the energy, like his role or her role is to reconcile certain desires we have and. That we aren't allowing ourselves because of something that's in our head about, you know, to me, I don't know, that idea of this, the Nine of Swords reversed and the devil, like, and this couple, if they could, you know, get past the imagined problems that they're having or the difficulty that, you know, things could turn out differently for them.
Right.
You know, sort of like, that's the... What was the point in the story in which, you know, it could have turned around? You know, even at the end, could they have reconciled themselves differently?
But isn't that often, mostly the case when two people, whether they're in a relationship or friends or, you know, buying something at the counter at a store, mm-hmm. Two people, if they get into an argument or a disagreement, it's because they're stuck in their own perception of things and their own way of thinking, and they're not willing to mm-hmm. see the other person's point of view or to listen to what the other person is saying. And the reversal here, to me, says if you stop assuming you know who and what the devil is and you start working with the devil and the energy of the devil and develop that relationship, you may find that you will develop a different understanding and perception that won't be quite so contentious or fearful.
Mm. I like it.
So
that's the devil, kids.
That is. And I might encourage people that are listening, especially if you're listening in October, but also think about whenever you're listening to this, because you can always listen to the archives of this at the same URL on Blog Talk where you're listening to the show live. You can listen to the archives there any time of the show. And also on iTunes, you can find it. So I would encourage people, whenever you're listening, think about what wisdom questions and readings you can do that might relate to the season or the month or something that is going on for you in that time period. So if people are listening right now, they might do wisdom readings on what are ghosts, or, you know, are spirits real? Because we hear that the veil at this time of year is thinnest, and so therefore it's easiest for the spirit world to come over. You know, so we could ask, what are those spirits? Or is being able to talk to people on the other side real? Or, you know, play with
How
the idea. Yeah, play with the idea of wisdom readings. But you could use it for things that are very of the moment, for when you're doing it. It doesn't always have to just be something that's out of left field that you could do it. You know, what is God? I mean, or whatever, that you could do any time. I don't know if there's a specific time to do that. But it can be very enlightening and interesting, I think, and fun. It's not bad to have fun, even though
it's funny. It's
it
a
may
technique
throw you
that
a curveball.
You, it's definitely a tech. One of those techniques that works both to read playfully and gravely at the same time. You get to ask kind of, you know, incredible questions. You know, what are ghosts? How do I contact the dead? You know, what? But also with the idea of this is me exploring this, you can be a bit light about it. So you allow yourself to ask those great, you know, questions.
Right. Or it's okay to have laughter and levity amidst looking at something seriously, you know. It doesn't all have to be said in hushed tones and grand pronouncements. You can also allow a bit of levity while still getting the underlying seriousness of it.
Yeah. Although that's fun too.
Yes. So, hopefully, people enjoyed both hearing what came up for who is death, what is death, who is the devil, what is the devil. And also, we would encourage people to explore trying out doing some wisdom readings, especially if you do some this month. Come on over to our Facebook page, The Amethyst Oracle, and post what card you get, what question you asked, and let us know what came up for you, how you interpreted that, what you thought that card represented. And other people can also chime in to say, oh, you know, that also makes me think this, this, and this. So we would encourage you to pop over to the Facebook page and continue this conversation with your insights and your experiences trying this out. And I just want to remind people that if you are interested in receiving a reading tonight during the show, that you can Skype in from the show page, or you can call in, and the phone number is 646-716-5510. And we won't be doing readings right away. We'll do it a little later in the show after our guest coming up, Hyperion. But it's always good to get in the queue now, because oftentimes there are more people than we can get to during a show. So if you want to go ahead and get in the queue, then you can do that. You can still just listen to the show, and then we'll see you there and bring you in for a reading. So 646-716-5510, or Skype in from the show page. So coming up next, Charlie, is our special guest this month, Hyperion.
The amazing Hyperion.
It is true. And he is the founder of The Unnamed Path and is going to talk to us of things such as death walkers, divination, and dark gods and goddesses, all perfectly appropriate for this time of month, I think.
So dim the lights.
That's right. Light a candle.
There we go.
Get a bowl of water.
Open a window just enough to create a draft.
Yeah. Get a bowl of water, put a few drops of oil on it, set it next to the candle, stare into it as you listen to the interview. And we want to let people know, be prepared, because Hyperion is also going to offer us a simple ritual and technique for contacting our own spirits of our ancestors, contacting our own dead. So, you know, pay attention for that. You might want to have something, either an iPad to take notes on, or I guess if you still live in that era, paper and pen to write down what to do. It'll certainly be something that I think that you would enjoy trying out this time of year. Perhaps your little Halloween ritual or something to do on Halloween this year would be this particular technique. So keep an ear out for that. And stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break. And as soon as we come back from that break, we're going to meet and enter into conversation with our guest, Hyperion.
As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance? With Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. Introducing our newest show, the second and fourth Saturday mornings each month, From Beyond, with mother-daughter psychics Nadia Shapiro and Barbara Williams. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Hyperion is the founder of the Unnamed Path, a shamanic path for men who love men, and host of his podcast by the same name. His experience includes over 17 years of teaching magical traditions, including astrology, energy healing, shamanism, meditation, spirit contact and possession, spell work, herbalism, and divination. He is a regular presenter at Pantheacon and works actively for the civil rights and empowerment of the queer community. For more information on Hyperion, check out his website, unnamedpath.com. Now, please join us in welcoming him to the show.
So welcome to the show, Hyperion. Thank you very much for joining Charlie and myself this evening.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure as always. Really a big fan of your show. And of course, it's nice to hear both of you again. It's been a while.
Right on.
And as you, as we heard in the intro, one of the things that you are primarily known for is having started the tradition, the Unnamed Path, which is specifically geared towards men who love men. And maybe you can tell us a little bit both about the path as well as what the impetus was to start a tradition that had that specific of a focus.
Okay. Well, the Unnamed Path is a emerging shamanic tradition for men who love men, consisting of four primary parts: magic and prophecy, shamanism, death walking, and energy healing. And these four parts, these four arts, are based off of the natural magical talents that we as men who love men have. The Unnamed Path is not coven structured or group structured like many Wiccan traditions. but it is a little more like a loose confederacy of independent shamans. We're all formally trained, we're all formally initiated, and when needed, we come together, we band together to work on big goals, for example, big social needs, or for example, with the whole Prop 8 situation in California with gay marriage, we banded together to work proactively to try to change things. So in that respect, we're sort of a tribe, and we are actually located all over the U.S. We have initiated brothers in Texas. We've got some brothers in New York now, up in the Bay Area of California, of course, Southern California, and our numbers are growing every day. And one of the things that really inspired me, or rather I should say one of the reasons why I was directed to create this tradition, because I was directed by my guides and the ancestors to go forward with it, is that I was raised in a Catholic household, and once I realized that I was a gay man, I quickly left Catholicism and sort of went on a spiritual walkabout trying to find my path, and eventually ended up in neo-paganism and Wicca. And I practiced Wicca for many, many, many years. And while I did find acceptance in the Wiccan groups that I belonged to, it was very hard to find a tradition that was uniquely celebrating mysteries of men who love men, the queer mysteries, mysteries for gay people. Okay, we were certainly loved and accepted, and they certainly liked all the cool robes that we could sew and altars that we could make. But there was nothing there reflecting my unique spirit in the gods and goddesses that we worked with. You know, it was always that the god and the goddess were consorts to one another, and they gave birth to a baby, and that baby was the next god for the next year. And, you know, that kind of very heterocentric understanding of spirituality. And it never resonated with my true nature and my manner of loving. So I started searching and seeking, and I learned shamanism from a friend of mine, sort of a neo-shamanic technique that uses music in order to induce trance. He had learned from Chumash Indians and from Peyote Indians. And so I kind of like inherited that neo-shamanic approach to spirituality and started seeking out information on my own. And at first, the Unnamed Path was a patchwork of information, magical techniques here, gods and goddesses that I would meet there, ancestors that I would meet. It was sort of a hodgepodge. And I had a hard time trying to record it all and try to keep this web of associations in written form. So I decided to start podcasting on the revelations that I was receiving and on the information that I was accumulating. And that's how the podcast of the Unnamed Path was born. And eventually my guides and the ancestors said, okay, it's time to teach people in person. And that was about, I want to say about 6 years ago. And now we're a growing tradition and initiating and training new brothers every day.
And one of the things I really appreciated at the as a Wiccan, as a practicing Wiccan, at the core of the Unnamed Path, you have the dark god and the light god and their interaction. And I found that so refreshing. You mentioned earlier, just a moment ago, like, people embracing gay men, sort of, kind of. But the way they would do it would sometimes be funny. Like, you know, everyone has the god and goddess within themselves. So, you know, it's okay, gay person. You just have to get in touch with your inner heterosexual couple.
Right.
And that doesn't exist in as such in the Unnamed Path tradition. Can you talk a little bit about how those two manifest?
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the common sort of magical justifications you'll find within many neo-pagan groups is that there have to be men and women present, and that is to reflect the polarity of gender, so that there's always a priest, there's always a priestess, and regardless of whatever sexual orientation you are, as long as both bits are represented in the circle, we can do what we need to do because polarity, you know. And then I hear a lot of queer people that are still participating in those groups say, oh, well, I just need to tune my own inner polarity to the opposite of my partner. And so they're still operating in this sort of heterocentrist model of there must be a plus and a minus. There must be, you know, a guy and a girl. And we sort of turned that on its head with when we met the gods of the Unnamed Path. The light god and the dark god are actually one god. They're actually the same guy, okay? He's just in two different states of being, or rather two states of his awareness, okay? The light god is very upperworldly, very cerebral, intellectual, logical. He encourages us to learn to go with the flow on things and abdicate our own egos and our own individual needs to understand to flow with the grand pattern of destiny. And so he has sort of this big perspective understanding on what existence is like. And actually, we say that the light god is actually the elder of the two gods. He was the one that created animals, created humanity, created living things in the world. Eventually, at some point, he wanted to experience what it was like to be the very thing he was creating. And so he made a sacrifice. He gave up all of the light that he had. He gave up this celestial, amazing, upperworldly experience to throw himself down into the creation and be like the very beasts he had created. And thus was born the Dark God. And so the Dark God is very bestial and is very physical and sexual and very self-serving and self-indulgent. For all the selflessness of the Light God, the Dark God is just as self-indulgent. And so we get, you know, he sort of changed and transformed his being so that he could experience what it was like to be disconnected from things, to be an individual, to be unique, to be on your own and struggling. I mean, he experienced fear for the first time, you know. And so in that experience of the Dark God, he had to learn how to get along in this world. He took pity upon the souls of humanity and tends to them and takes care of them in the underworld. When we die, he sets a feast for us at a table so that we always have wine to drink and we always have food to eat. And he saw the solitude and the almost how the dead had been forgotten. He saw their loneliness within himself. And so that sympathy kicked in and he started caring for them. And it's almost like we as individual unique humans are little agents for the grand experiment that the Dark God is going through to experience what it's like to be a human, to be a person, to be an individual. And with each accomplishment that we attain, with each goal that we meet, we are justifying that act of the Dark God to give up everything that he gave up when he was the Light God. And with each little accomplishment we make, the Dark God gets lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter. Okay, he makes his way back up to the upper world. Now, there's an interesting thing here, of course. Any good religion has to have a seemingly unreconcilable paradox. So here we have the Light God in the upper world and the Dark God in the underworld at the same time. Okay, if you can resolve that in your mind, I want you to try to. They see themselves in the other. You know, so the Dark God sees himself in the Light God reflected back at him, and the Light God looks down at creation and sees the Dark God reflected back at him, and they crave and yearn for one another. And the Light God and Dark God have a queer loving relationship with one another. They are lovers. Even though they are one and the same, they are lovers. And they meet on the surface of the earth and make love with one another, just as we make love as men who love men with our brothers. And when they do make love, the Light God transforms into the Dark God and descends to the underworld. And the Dark God is redeemed for his sacrifice and transforms into become the Light God and returns to the upper world. So there's this constant going back and forth between the Light God and the Dark God and the ecstasy of their sexual connection and bliss and shared love on the surface of the earth is what makes them transform and transmute into one another. And the beauty of that is we as men who love men can finally see ourselves reflected in our gods, right? We know what it's like to take our lover in our arms and see ourselves reflected in him and experience the amazing, powerful, healing, transmutational power of sex, especially when it's sacred and when it's engaged with an open, loving heart. And we can tap into that divine current in the manner with which we make love. So suddenly the gods are reflected in us and we are reflected in the gods, instead of us having to, you know, slap on a spiritual adapter to try to fit into an outlet that we don't belong in.
And you also don't neglect the female side, because you do Light goddess and the Dark goddess, correct?
Correct. The Light goddess and the Dark goddess are the other two deities in our tradition. And I should kind of preface going into the goddesses by explaining that we don't put a particular cultural lens on any of our gods or goddesses. So it's not like we're saying, oh, we worship Hecate, and we, you know, go with a Hellenic lens on all of our gods and goddesses. No, not at all. We think of our gods and goddesses as something that almost predates culture. Okay, it's as old as the men loving men experience. Okay, not the label of gay, because the label of gay is a political label that's relatively new, but the experience of a man loving another man. That's how old these gods are. Okay, so the goddesses for us are almost like the field of nature. The dark goddess is the void, the nothingness, the origin point at the center. You know, when you do geometry and you lay out your little graph, she's that origin point at the very center, right? No dimension, but there's a place, there's a space, there's a something. She is what existed before time and space exists. She is all potentiality. And then she, in an effort to experience change, to be able to break away from this void of just sort of non-existing, created herself. She recreated herself, almost like Madonna. She recreated herself into the light goddess. And she, the potentiality of the dark goddess became manifested into the light goddess. And we say the light goddess is all tangible manifestation in the universe. All the stars, all the planets, every rock, every leaf, every ocean, every breeze, that is the light goddess, right? But underneath that and between that matter, there is space. There's vacuum. There's nothingness. There's darkness. That is the dark goddess. She's always present and she underlies everything. And without her, the light goddess wouldn't exist. Manifestation, tangible matter wouldn't exist without space. And so in many ways we say the light goddess is the stars in the heavens and the dark goddess is the black space that embraces them and allows them to exist. So the goddesses are nature. They're the field of nature and existence. And the drama of the dark and light god interacting with one another takes place in that field of the goddess's existence. I hope that makes sense.
It does.
It took me a while the first time, I think, to kind of like try and reconcile the four of them. But what made it easier for me was when I started looking for stuff, because as a good pagan, you need to have stuff on your altar, especially statues. And I know you mentioned that the deities exist outside of particular cultures, which is great because it was kind of easy to see parallels,
right,
that were useful. That is true. Like I got hung up on Apollo and Pan. And then, and I started to stay away from that. But the one I found almost the most useful or interesting for a while, this sort of looked like a pairing of Archangel Michael and Lucifer in certain
very much so
ways. Yeah. And I was like, he used to be Catholic. That makes sense. And then, but I eventually landed on Phosphorus and Hesperus because they've got that divine pairing and there's not too much about them, so there's not too much baggage. But then after that, I was like, okay, light god, dark god, I can just deal.
Right, exactly. And you know, that's actually a very good point. We've had students that came from other pagan paths. Maybe they worked with Hellenic deities or they worked with Kemetic deities, and so they try to say, well, this is like that, so I'm just going to sort of take this god and put him over here in this unnamed path context. And what ends up happening is, you know, we are a revelatory path. We work a lot in the shamanic realm and expect our students to meet our gods and goddesses and build relationships with them. Well, we got to make sure you're meeting the right people. And the only way we can do that is by listening to your account, listening to the symbols that you bring back from journey work, from path workings, and validate whether or not you're connecting to the right energy matrix. And we had people that connect to something very close and similar. And I'm sure it's valid, and I know it is. It's real, but it's not our current. So that's one of the why I said it's dangerous, because you can actually end up connecting to the wrong current, and then that current eventually says, "Wait, why are you trying to use me this way? Why are you trying to work with me this way? This is not how I work." So it's an interesting challenge to get through, being a revelatory path.
And is, when you say men who love men, is that specifically cisgendered men, or is it anyone who identifies as male? How do you handle that currently kind of a hot right. button topic?
Right. So that topic was all the way back to last year at Pantheacon. Yeah. It's interesting. We say men who love men, meaning you have to identify as a man and you have to love men. So that includes That includes gay men, that includes bisexual men, that includes men who were born in masculine bodies, as well as men who were born in feminine bodies. And I took this question to my tribe and said, at what point do we feel it's appropriate for a trans man to be able to participate in our path? Because we do have certain mysteries that are actually tied to the physical body that we have. And there's certain aspects that, for example, if you were a man and you did not ejaculate, okay, if you were born a man and you did not ejaculate, you wouldn't be able to engage in those mysteries. Does that mean you can't follow the path? No, of course you can follow the path. Of course you can participate in it. You're just going to miss out on that little bit of fun, okay? But so we said, yeah, as long as the trans man has gone sufficiently through his transition that he feels comfortable with the gender and sex identity of being male and feels that he has dealt enough with his own transitional issues that he's ready to take on the transition of a spiritual path, because we all know that is a lot of baggage to go through a spiritual path, that they're welcome. They're absolutely welcome to study with us, to practice with us, to join with us. And as a matter of fact, we have an event taking place this weekend. While it is not a unnamed path event, we are hosting it. And all are welcome, and we have some trans men that are going to be attending. And so, you know, it is a Men Who Love Men event, and we use the same criteria for admission in that regard.
I also think Men Who Love Men, it would also seem to indicate that even someone who identifies as straight, because it's not men who have sex with men, it's men who love men, which is a whole other category.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you say men who have sex with men, you start getting into the labels that, like, sex health professionals use. You know what I'm saying? And it starts to get a little clinical. So that's the main reason we didn't use that. But there is absolutely a sexual element to our gods. And if you cannot have sex with another man, you're not going to be able to connect to the sacred sexual loving nature of our gods. So you're going to miss out. You know what I'm saying? It's like, could you philosophically study? I guess. But it's going to get to a point when you're not going to get to experience that divine connection. Again, remember, it's seeing the gods reflected in you and you reflected in the gods. If you don't have sex with men, then you're not being reflected in the gods. Right?
Makes sense to me. And you mentioned that the four paths, the four paths of the unnamed path, and one of them is magic and prophecy. And since we're the divination show, how does that prophecy element, magic and prophecy element, sort of work in the unnamed path?
It's a good question. Magic and prophecy go hand in hand. Magic is, of course, taking your will and using it to change the world around you, you know, making your goals happen using magical means. And prophecy is almost like the forecasting in order to find out what factors are affecting the situation, so you better know how to target your magic, as well as how will this spell turn out.
Divination before incantation?
Divination before incantation, and maybe even afterwards, you know, just sort of like a let's make sure that we launched the rocket in the right direction kind of thing, you know. And so it's very useful, and they very much go hand in hand. Now, our prophecy takes many forms. There is divination, which would use like a random tool, like shuffling cards or the throwing of runes or something like that. We also have what we call seership, which is doing prophecy work without tools. This is where you rely on the relationships you have with your gods and goddesses, with the guides that you have with your ancestors, even with your totem animals and so forth. And you enter into a shamanic state of altered consciousness in order to fetch the information that is the response to the questions people ask. And seership is really intense. All of our initiates, anyone who's been initiated in the unnamed path can do it. It's part of our training. But it's pretty cool because you plug in such a way that you could just push your cards aside and just boom, start answering da 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 and responding exactly what the ancestors are saying, what the gods are saying, and you can tell people where the answer is coming from, which is really great. My totem animals went and fetched this answer, and they say you need to do X, Y, and Z for this reason. Or my ancestor, my grandma says that you need to go look for a job in such and such place, you know. And so that way, you don't just get a psychic's word for it, you actually can say, well, you know, your grandma may be a nice lady, but I really don't want to take her advice. You know, you get another layer of meaning in there. We also do scrying, you know, which is sort of like somewhere between the two. You use a tool as a way to unfocus your gaze so that you can then receive inspiration from your guides and ancestors. So those are our primary methods of prophecy in the Unnamed Path. We also, of course, we are a possessory path. So our gods and goddesses can possess initiates. And if they're in the body of an initiate, then you're getting direct prophecy straight from the you know, mouth of the gods and goddesses.
And if somebody was interested in pursuing studying this path, but they thought that they don't have any skill or gift for doing divination and that kind of thing, do you feel that's something that can be taught to them? They don't have to worry about, well, I don't have that gift, so I guess I can't really follow this path because that's not going to be a part of it I can do.
Right. Absolutely, they can study with us. As a matter of fact, we train you on how to be the best diviner you can be, how to be the best seer you can be. I mean, it's kind of like I went to school in college for art. And I'll be the first person to say, when I went to art school, I couldn't draw to save my life. But when I got out of art school, I can draw, and I can draw very well. And so it's the same kind of way. I take the same sort of philosophy. You know, you're signing up for shaman school, and you have to learn how to use our tools. I expect people to show up for classes and not know a single thing, and am willing to answer the most basic of questions so that people have a really firm foundation. And of course, the challenge is if you do know a lot of information as a student, you have to go into that sort of that empty bowl philosophy of approach to education, where I've got to empty out all of my previous knowledge and be receptive to learning things new, because this style may be different than what I learned before, and who knows, it may work better.
Step back to beginner's mind.
Step back to beginner's mind. That's right. Exactly.
And so in the years that you've been now teaching this and ushering this tradition along, what might be one thing you've seen, if you just as a tip to people listening that think they would like to perhaps pursue magic, prophecy, divination, etc., what do you think is one thing you've seen that has always been a stumbling block? And how people can start to get beyond that.
Right. I think the most common obstacle I see people run into is self-doubt. You know, when they're first learning how to read cards, they're like, I know what that card means, but I doubt myself, and I don't know if I'm getting the right information. Or someone will go on a shamanic journey and come back and say, well, how do I know if it was real and I wasn't just making it up? You know, it's a very common question. And I always tell people, you know, when you enter into the realm of self-doubt, what you're doing is you're making a statement to the gods, to the guides, the ancestors, to the universe, to all, that you are disconnected from the divine, that you are not able to do this. You're basically saying, I'm separate from all that other stuff. And unless I am that other stuff, I am somehow not legit and not okay. And that's a blasphemy. I tell people that is a blasphemous statement. And you really have to instead move into a place of hope and a place of trust and a place of spiritual vulnerability enough to say, I'm going to take a risk and say the image that's coming to my mind. And I'm going to just put it out there and tell you everything I saw in my shamanic journey. Even if I think it sounds a little out there, I'm going to just say it, okay, without judgment. And those times where you move into that mind of innocence and into that place of trust and report things purely devoid of any kind of self-doubt, that's when you start becoming a phenomenal diviner or an amazing prophet or whatever it happens to be. It's casting off the mantle of self-doubt.
Very cool. That's the heart. I don't know, that self-doubt part for any kind of scrying or any kind of intuitive, for me it was always the feeling that, oh man, am I making this up? You know, mm-hmm. is this in my head? And you're like, yes, and?
Right.
But
right.
That's the hardest part for me.
Right. And as shamans, when we do shamanic journey work, you see some pretty fantastical stuff. I mean, we've got one brother that gets to see shamanic journeys with Star Wars characters in them. Okay, but let me tell you, his shamanic journeys are the most powerful ones. And we tell our students early on, you know, whenever you're doing shamanic journey work, your guides are going to use whatever visual language is in your mind, whatever is significant for you. If you are really into Japanese anime, you are going to be seeing Japanese anime characters in your shamanic journeys because they represent things for your psyche and for your spirit, just like you know, Star Wars means a lot to our brother. When he gets his shamanic journeys and we read them, you know, if you were not a shaman and reading it, you'd go, what the heck? But if you understand the context for him and what it represents, they're some of the most powerful, amazing 3D IMAX surround sound kind of shamanic journeys. They're amazing, you know? Wow. So you have to kind of learn that when you move into the shamanic realm of revelatory experience, there is, there's a certain amount of absurdity that's part of the equation. And you learn to embrace it. Instead of needing everything to be black and white and hard line, you're willing to be flexible and go, okay, well, let me explore it and let me accept it for now. And then I'll test the spirit just to make sure that, you know, I'm not out of my mind, but I'm going to trust that the process is working.
There. You know, shamanic journeys in 3D and IMAX are so old tradition. I'm now moving towards 4K shamanic journeys.
4K, okay. Smell-o-vision shamanic journey.
Smell-o-vision, that's right. You have to put on your glasses before the shamanic journey. So of the four paths, I don't know about anyone else, but the one that made me pause the most also probably seems like something we should cover in this October episode, since this is the time of ghosts and spirits. What is death walking?
Death walking, yes. I purposefully gave it a spooky name. I will own up.
I mean, I'm glad you did, because I think like the world of mediumship has become very like, I'm sure she's great, but Doreen Virtue, you know?
Okay, with her angel cards, bless her heart. But here's the thing, it's death walking, the name death walking is a name that refers to the relationship that the medium has with the force of death. Okay, not only are we mediums, but we actually walk with death as a force, meaning that you have a healthier relationship with it. You're not scared of it. You're not freaked out by the fact that death is a part of life. You know, I know a lot of pagans say, death is a part of life and death and rebirth. And, you know, and the talk is great. But then when the chips are down and somebody's dying in front of them, they start freaking out. You know, a death walker, we actually encourage people who want to study death walking to go and work in hospitals or hospice care where people are actively dying. And you can give them a death with dignity, where you can sit by their side, listen to their regrets, listen to their hopes, make them feel like they're not disposable. You know, let them understand that they're important and walk them through the death process. And then once they've died, actually communicate with them on the other side and continue to counsel them through the confusion that they're experiencing as they lose their body. Okay. And so that's why we call it death walking. It's not just mediumship. It's more than that. Now, we do talk to spirits of the dead, but midwifing the dying is one of the big roles of a death walker, and being able to help someone through the transition of death. Okay. It's just as sacred of a transition as birth. Right. So that's what death walking is. It's communicating with spirits of the dead and helping people through their dying process in a spiritual context. And so we do have a holiday that we throw once a year called the Circle of Bones, which we actually did a Circle of Bones ceremony at PantheaCon this year in 2013. And it was really powerful. It was really an amazing experience to sit up there with five other death walkers and work in this role of mediumship to allow the spirits of the dead to communicate, to allow the living to receive their messages as well as transmit their messages to the dead, and to give them an agency through which they could make their peace with one another. And, you know, normally we hold this ceremony in the round, like we all sit in a circle, and I'm going to try to do that for 2014 if PantheaCon will have us back. But this year, because of the volume of people we had to set it up like rows, and it almost became like a church setting. We had people processing up the center aisle on their knees, almost as if they were making a pilgrimage to a holy site. It was one of the most powerful and humbling experiences I've ever been through, that I had to really just like check my ego, set it aside, and just be a really clear channel and don't allow what's happening right now in the room to deter me from being a clear mouthpiece for the dead. And it was so challenging because I wanted to cry, and I'm like, no, I've got to focus on what I'm doing. I've got to stay here and now. And it was really powerful, but that's like sort of a formalized ceremony that we do. It's the Circle of Bones, but we also do smaller spirit contact circles or seances, if you will, as needed throughout the year. It's, we teach our brothers how to communicate with the dead. And I think most men who love men will find with a little bit of training that you have quite a knack for it.
And you use the term ancestors a lot. Can you maybe speak a little bit about what that means for you in this tradition when you refer to ancestors?
Right. Well, we as men who love men have two ancestral streams. We have our ancestors of blood, which were the people that gave birth to us, you know. Or if you're adopted, I actually count your adoptive family in the ancestors of blood because you both ate the same food. You were raised together. You know, I consider that blood ancestry. But then we have a second ancestry, and that's what I call the ancestry of heart. These are spirits of men who love men who went before us. Okay, this is a tribe that we belong to, a family that we belong to beyond our blood family because we all loved the same. We share similar perspectives on life by having experienced life through the same lens of men loving men. Some of them are mighty ancestors that went before men who, of great artistry or great courage or great leadership. And when we say ancestors of men who love men with a capital A, we're talking about the mighty dead who were men who loved men. These are, like I said, men who are phenomenal leaders, who are powerful artists, poets, who were fierce warriors, people who fought for our rights. These are like our the heads of our spiritual tribe in the spirit world. And they're accessible by all men who love men, and they're there to support us. And they're the ones who awakened the unnamed path in me. They awaken the path in other men as well at the same time, by the way. I'm not the sole owner of this. I'm not like some kind of divine prophet. There are other men on the earth who were receiving the same information at the same time I was. They just didn't do anything with it. You know, I ran with it. I'm an ambitious Capricorn. I ran with it. They didn't. They just kind of used it for their own personal work and left it at that. But that's what I talk about when I'm talking about ancestors with a capital A of men who love men. It's those people. And ancestors, in the general term with the lowercase a, it's the stream of blood and the stream of heart that emanates out of each of us in terms of backward dead people.
I was at a ritual a while ago that was LGBT oriented. Mm-hmm. And one of the phrases they used, which I really liked, was they said, we all walk along the road that's made of the bones of those that came before us.
Absolutely.
And it was to remind us to make sure that we both honor and respect that and remember that at all times. Because I think that we do, in our community, as well as society in general, tend to forget about who came before to set the stage for what we may now be able to be enjoying.
Right.
And that's kind of a neglect of ancestor worship that is so prevalent in many other cultures. But mm-hmm. we really neglect in ours. And I think part of that is because we have a fear of death in our
true.
Culture.
That's
and
true.
So if someone was hearing this, and I think a lot of people would be held back from wanting to pursue this because of their own fear of going there. Charlie and I spoke at a little, wasn't really a conference. It's like a monthly thing.
Mm-hmm. Gathering.
And there was a woman there that does shamanic work, and she was relaying a story that she had gotten a call or something from somebody about doing some connection with the dead and that kind of thing. And she was sending that person someplace else because she said, I don't really deal in the death realm,
mm-hmm.
which I thought, well, my goodness, that seems like such a natural part of the shamanic work that, but
right.
anyway.
Right.
So what would you suggest to people if they feel a fear or a hesitance or a reticence about going into that realm?
Well, it's just like anything else. Whenever you experience fear regarding something, it's because there's some power to be attained on the other side of that fear. There's always something there that's intimidating and yet at the same time tantalizing. And whether it's an understanding and a knowledge which is what's on the other side of that fear is just not you. You know, it's not part of me. The power you get is a firmer understanding of self coming out of it. I always tell people go with somebody who is trained, who knows what they're doing, that is a qualified death walker, and experience it before you cast judgment. And I think most people will go into it a little timid, a little concerned, a little afraid. Like you said, because our society is very youth-oriented, it's very life-oriented. We are a young country and a young society that's all about youth. And, I mean, even living seniors are forgotten by our society, okay, let alone dead people. You see all kinds of ads to, let's help the children, and what about the children? And everyone forgets about seniors, okay? So it's the same kind of thing. We want to deny our mortality. We are scared of it. But in the process, we have an unhealthy relationship with it. We have a fetishized relationship with the force of death. And doing death walking work, going through the experience of talking to spirits of the dead and receiving a message from the dead that you just cannot deny came from somebody that you know was dead, is a very healing experience, because then you realize, oh, wait a minute, death is not finality. Death is not an end. Death is not silence. You know, and you start to heal the relationship you have with death, and you don't fear it as much. And then you suddenly start to take appreciation for things like life and aging and how important it is for us to support our elders and seniors. And, you know, you get a whole new perspective on time itself, in addition to what it does to our bodies. So I tell people, look at what it is that you truly fear. Okay. Typically it's your own mortality. You know, a lot of it is cultural. And then I say, go with somebody who's trained and experience it before, with an open mind, before you cast aspersions. And I think you'll come away from it really with your mind open. It's kind of like sushi. A lot of people are scared of it. And then once they have it, they realize, wow, that's really great stuff. So, you know,
it's funny because even in the, you know, in the very open-minded world of divination in the New Age, it's still so potent. We were talking with Chaz Bogan, who makes Ouija style talking boards, and you'll hear people who love tarot, love astrology, pendulums, but they'll tell you some twisted story about when they used a Ouija board when they were 12 and the planchette flew across the room.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yes.
There's planchettes flying across my room right now.
Woo!
Right, there goes one. No,
they're here.
Right. Some of that is sort of what we inherited from a Western European culture, where the dead were largely something to be feared and respected. And see, I am Cuban. My family came to the United States in 1961, and I was born here. And Cuba is much more intimately tied to African aspects of culture, and because there's such a huge, you know, population of people that were brought in the slave trade to the Caribbean islands. And so there, the West African perspective on the dead is very different. The dead are friendly. The dead are allies. The dead are people to honor and remember, and they will in turn support you. And so I think I inherited a little bit of that perspective toward the dead, which made it much more comfortable for me to at least approach these arts and then investigate for myself. And then I was like, wait a minute, oh, there's really something here. There really is something here. So it's the common cultural divide between the friendly dead versus the dead to be feared of. And I think as Europeans, we, you know, many of us inherited that dead to be feared of culture. And that's what permeates a lot of modern paganism. Because let's face it, modern paganism in the United States is very Eurocentric. It really is. And it took a big hit in the 70s from the New Age white light movement. And I think we've been focused on light for so long that we kind of blinded ourselves to the darkness. And now the darkness is starting to become this nagging thing in the back of our mind that we have to address as a community. As diviners as well, we need to be willing to look at the shadow aspect of what we do. You know, just because the tower card falls doesn't mean that it's going to be a terrible, horrible experience for everyone, because that bolt of lightning that comes out of the sky to destroy the tower is the bolt of lightning of God's truth dismantling the illusions that we've created. So does it suck? Yeah. Is it painful? Yeah. But out of the darkness comes light. So, you know, it's just, you have to recognize both halves of the equation, life and death, light and dark.
And when you use the term dark, just to clarify for people, that's not anything to do with dark, meaning the bad side of things, the evil side of things, or even the negative side of things. It's just the opposite of the light.
Well, I'm gonna take you back two steps further and say labeling things in good and bad is something that stops dialogue. Those are value judgments instead of statements of fact. And so, you know, for example, is a tiger bad? well, you know, it's got giant teeth and it kills a lot of things and it could kill me and it's scary. And, you know, is it bad? Is it good? It just is. You know, and I think if we were to embrace a more nature-oriented look at the world itself, we wouldn't place value judgments of good and bad on things. Things just are. So dark is that which is not light, is that which is absence, is that which is lack, is that which is there is fear in darkness. You know, love would be light and dark would be fear. Fear isn't necessarily bad. Fear can save your life. Right? That rush of adrenaline and fear can be the very thing that makes you jump out of the way of an oncoming bus. In that case, fear was good. It saved you, you know? So I tend to shy away from discussions of good and bad. And I tend to look at things like, let's see them. Are they light? Are they dark? Is it manifest? Is it potential? You know, what is it? And I think that leaves you more room to have an honest dialogue that leads towards ultimate spiritual discovery.
Right. It's just that I think people in our society, even if it's just by osmosis, when they hear like dark God, they would start to associate that with devil.
Right.
Versus light God. And so it was just to clarify that's nothing to do with how you're using that terminology.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not Satan. No. Mm-hmm. I have no interest in Satan. Satan is a human cop-out for human shortcomings. Satan is a poster boy for all of the negative aspects that are part of humanity that we don't want to look at. Things like our, you know, being a selfish jerk and not caring about other people and hurting people. You know, again, I tend not to talk about things as good and bad, but, you know, is the dark God Satan? No, he's not. He's not.
Got it.
but there is darkness within the dark God that can be seen within us, that is part of our nature as being animals, that if we take an open, honest look at, instead of immediately labeling it as something bad and running away from it, that we might discover some truth about ourselves.
Very cool. Now, if someone, because the time of the year, was a little bit curious about doing some beginner level death walking, just like getting a taste for it, do you have any recommendations?
Yes.
That they could,
yes,
begin their process?
I'm going to give you a simple little ceremony that anybody can do, okay? I'm going to preface this by saying you need to go to the grave of somebody that you loved, okay? If you don't have a graveyard nearby of somebody you loved, I'm very sorry. I'm not going to give you anything more advanced, but I'll give you this. Go to the graveyard and visit somebody that you love that's buried there. It can be a relative. It can be a deceased wife or husband or lover. It could be a deceased pet, frankly. It could be anything. When you get to the gate of the ceremony, make a small offering of 3 pennies. This is an offering made to the spirits of the land that guard that place. Okay, that's all it is. It is saying, please allow me access to this sacred place so that I can come and go and not take a bunch of extra crap with me, okay? It's a statement of honor and respect. So you just leave the 3 pennies right there as you walk in. Seek the grave of your deceased loved one. Bring flowers, maybe bring a glass-encased candle so it's a little safer. If you feel so inclined and you want to offer a libation to the deceased, you could bring their favorite beverage, maybe a little flask of whiskey or just some fresh, cool water, something like that. And what you want to do is you want to go up to their headstone, clean the headstone off. Okay. That right there is an act of sacrifice and saying, you know, I'm respecting you. I want your memory to be clear. I want to show you that I'm doing what I can to tend to you when your physical body isn't here. Okay, hold the flowers in your hand, hold the drink in your hand, and sit on the grave. Okay, take a few deep, calm, cleansing breaths and allow waves of relaxation to go from your head down to your feet. And then call out the name of your loved one 3 times and say, I, state your name, am here to visit you, to pay you honor and respect, and to have some time with you. And then just speak to them from your heart. Now, you don't have to speak out loud. You can use your inner voice for this, but talk to them about what's troubling you, about what may be on your mind, about anything like that. And then when you're done talking, sit quietly and listen, and you will receive messages back. Okay. You will receive impressions that come to your mind, images, ideas that pop in your head. Don't disregard them, because this is where that self-doubt comes in. You're like, oh, I made that up, or oh, I'm just, my mind is wandering and I'm worrying about leaving the iron on before I left the house. You know, don't let don't dismiss that stuff. Just allow it to come to your mind without judgment and just take note of it. When you're done listening and perceiving, place the flowers on the gravestone. Take the beverage and pour it out on the earth on top of the grave and say, I offer this to you as an offering of thanks to cool and refresh your spirits. Cap it off. Give them your love and say your farewell. And then take 3 steps backward away from the grave, turn around, and leave. And on your way out, what I like to do is I like to either stamp my foot 3 times or knock on the door 3 times or something like that and say, one day I'll be back, but today is not that day. And then go home. And I usually go home by a different route just in case I decided to pick up a straggler that wanted to come with me. And, you know, I'll lose them on the route home by taking a different route. Okay? That is a very simple act that you can do as a death walker to communicate with your loved ones, to show them respect and reverence, and to get their support, especially if you come to them with an issue, like you're trying to get a job or get a new apartment or patch up a relationship. You can go to them for advice and help. And they will support you. And the more you go and the more that you tend to that relationship and take care of your spirits of your deceased, the more they will be there for you so that you don't even have to go to the cemetery anymore. You can be at home cooking dinner and you reach out to grandma with your mind and she's there talking to you and helping you and assisting you. She may come to you in dreams. You know, it's one of those things that as you develop the relationship, they're always there for you, ready to help you.
And there are some traditions that think that this time of year, especially the end of October, October 31st, is a time when the veil is thinnest, when it's most easy to connect with the spirit realm. Do you feel that that applies? I mean, do you feel that this time of year is good for that too? And maybe that would be a good time for somebody to try doing this? Or are there particular times like full moon or something that you think would be particularly conducive to somebody trying this?
Right. If you're just starting out, I find that practicing death walking when the leaves in your environment are starting to fall is best. Okay. So that way it really depends on where you live. Like here in Southern California, our leaves are barely starting to turn color. If you go further north, I'm sure they're already like in full color change and going to drop any minute. So it depends on your environment. I'd say look at your environment. Or if there is a lot of death sweeping the land. That's information I've received in a shamanic journey. So let's say that it's hunting season or something like that, right? There's a lot of death sweeping the land. Or God forbid if there's God forbid there's a big natural disaster and a lot of people are dying. That is a good time for you to do death walking because naturally souls of the dead are seeking rest. They're trying to make their way into the underworld, and you can help them in the process. And I do think, you know, I hearken back to my old days as a Wiccan, and I do think that this time of year, that the veil between the living and the dead really is quite thin. And for folks in the Southern Hemisphere, of course, it would be the opposite time of year, you know, beginning of May, same kind of thing. It just really depends on your environment.
I've also heard that this time of year, October 31st, for us in this hemisphere, October 31st is when it's easiest for the spirit realm to come and access our side, mm-hmm. and that, May Day or the beginning of May is when it's easiest for us to connect with that side.
Right. I'd agree with that, especially considering that in the underworld, I think things are a little reflected. So like when it's daytime here, it's nighttime there, which is why nighttime is such a good time to contact spirits of the dead because they're awake. In the underworld, it's you know, daytime there. Similarly, when it's Samhain here, it's Beltane over there, right? Because think about it. Whenever a soul dies here in the physical world, a ghost or spirit is born in the spirit world. It's their Beltane. It's their time for reproduction, mm-hmm. right? And where Beltane here, everything is being born to new life, those are souls of the dead that are reincarnating and taking physical form. So Beltane here in the physical world is Samhain in the land of the dead.
Right.
So that makes sense.
So if someone was interested or intrigued by the Unnamed Path, first of all, we will let them know. They can always go to unnamedpath.com
yep.
to find out more information. Mm-hmm. And kind of two questions around this for you to kind of move towards closing out our conversation. First of all, if someone was intrigued but waiting for a sign that it was the right thing for them to do, mm-hmm. what would you suggest for them to look out for that would be indicative that it is a sign or a calling or something drawing them that is coming specifically from the light / dark god and or goddess for this particular path?
That's a hard one because I think signs are very individual and they're very personal. Again, they talk to your visual language and what speaks to you. But, you know, some of the hallmarks of the dark god, for example, if you see a horny guy, you know, a guy with horns on his head, that's pretty much his, you know, his symbol. That's him coming forward, especially if you dream of, you know, hot guy with horns on his head coming to make love to you in the middle of the night. Might just be him. The dark goddess and the dark god are very prone to reach out to people more so than the light goddess or light god. They're very detached from the individual experience, while the dark ones are very invested in the individual experience. The dark goddess tends to talk to people in dreams about things like spiders, dreams about old women where you can't see her face. That's very common as well. or if you find yourself in a spiritual path where you're not seeing your own natural men who love men rhythm being reflected in that path and you're starting to question and seek, that's all it took for me to find my way on the path. So it could be that as well.
And people don't have to be in physical proximity to you to start
right.
pursuing this path because you teach from distance as well, correct?
Right. That's one of the cool things. Modern era, we actually hold our classes using Google Hangouts or Skype, depending on the teacher. And, you know, we pick a mutually agreeable time amongst all the students that want to participate. And then we start the class. And the class is typically a year-long apprenticeship. Each class meets about every other week. And the lessons themselves are like 2 hours long. We currently have 5 teachers that are teaching at any given moment. And we announce when classes are available or starting up, either on our Facebook page, where you can search for The Unnamed Path on Facebook, or on our website at unnamedpath.com. And we also have a Google Plus page, although there's not as much traffic on it as with most things Google Plus. We do have a Yahoo group, but we're going to be transitioning away from that because Yahoo groups are having problems right now. But your best bet is going to be Facebook or the unnamedpath.com website. And also, if you want to listen to the podcast, you can actually search for The Unnamed Path on iTunes, and it's available for free for download. We've got over 70 episodes to entertain you in the process.
It's a fabulous, fabulous podcast, and it was one of my big inspirations to ever produce a podcast when I started listening to it about 4 years ago. So well done on you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I was also going to say it's a really great series of podcasts to listen to as really a good introduction and foundation to what The Unnamed Path is about. And would probably really help somebody understand it better, as well as to really figure out whether it sounds like it's something that is for them to pursue.
Right, yeah, because it's complicated. You know, I had to record 70 episodes to get the bulk of it out. So, yeah, it's complicated.
So I think with that, we will both encourage people that are feeling pulled or intrigued by what they've heard tonight to check out the website at unnamedpath.com and perhaps consider pursuing studying that path a bit if it feels right to them. And we will say thank you to Hyperion for being willing to join us this evening. We are recording this just a little bit before the show airs, and that is because, as was mentioned earlier, he has the inaugural Stone and Staying retreat coming up this weekend,
right,
which is the weekend right before the show airs. So we also want to wish you much luck with that. I've looked at the programming and stuff, and I think it sounds like it's going to be quite an amazing weekend, despite the little bumps that have to be gotten over for anything inaugural.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for the, you know, the good wishes for that weekend. And thank you for having me on. It's been a real treat to chat with both of you and to be able to talk about something that's really dear to my heart and that has really transform the lives of many, many, many men that we've taught and trained in this tradition. So thank you again.
And probably that's a key thing. If somebody is called to this path, be prepared to be transformed in your life. Don't go into it lightly.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for having been here.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Sentinel who brings you through the portal. On the wind, their voices call. Answer me the simple rhyme. When is death an enemy? And when is death a friend of mine? They rattle windows and shake. Their bones are shaking. Spirits rising, singing on the wind. They miss the feast and crave the fire, and need a sense of belonging. The sky, the night, are filled with cries of longing. The children come, who do not know why we cannot feel them. And angry men who died too soon because no one could heal them. The voices. They reach to touch the light in us from tombs within the ground. The spirits move here in our midst. All are so invited, except their pallid company, and do not know. Ring the bell, whirl in the gloom. Black and gray and white as dust come shrieking from the tomb. And turn us to tomorrow. We'll offer bread and sweet to appease your sorrow.
At Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change, and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us, host a show, or be a guest. Or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
And we are back. Hello, Charlie.
The dead, it would seem.
That's right. Took a little stroll through the underworld there.
Hearing yes.
The whispers of the dead.
Are you being constitutional?
Yes. And once again, we would like to thank Hyperion for joining us in conversation. And hopefully people out there enjoyed and perhaps heard something new that they weren't familiar with. And if you're interested in pursuing more of the Unnamed Path, you can find them at theunnamedpath.com. You can find them on Facebook. Just look for The Unnamed Path. And also, if you want the podcast on iTunes, just do a search for The Unnamed Path. So our thanks go out to Hyperion. And so this brings us... What was that?
Sorry. I just had no condolences, but... Anyway.
And that brings us to our regular monthly segment of Living the Queer Life.
Where we the queer death.
Well, this month, perhaps.
There we go.
And that is our segment where we each pull a card to help people have a little guidance and insight into how to be their queerest selves this coming month. And all that means is to be more your authentic self and be willing to not settle for simply fitting into the norm, but doing your life your way.
Oh, right on. And I pulled a card from the Halloween Tarot. It's, if you ever want a dark deck that's actually very light, the Halloween Tarot is a great choice. It's kind of a spooky, cartoony Halloween world version of the Rider-Waite. And the card I pulled a few minutes ago cracked me up because, of course, I pulled the Death card. Like, I looked at it, I'm like, well, of course you came up, Death card. And in this deck, it's a skeleton in a garden watering with a watering can, and he's watering the pumpkins and other plants, and there's symbols of death and life all around him. There's a vulture on the fence, but there's also a symbol of an Egyptian ankh on the fence, so it's sort of life and death. And I thought about that, and I was thinking you'd recommended that we be a bit more action-oriented. What's the thing people can do this month? And to me, that represents you have to replace the things you don't want with things you need in order to let something go, in order to really move on, in order to not be controlled by the past. You have to bring something new in, you know, or else you just, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So get a makeover, you know, looking at this death card with its, you know, like, you know, get a new wardrobe to represent the new you. You know, I was thinking about trick-or-treating. And trick-or-treating is fun, and it's the gay holiday or whatever. But we can, we get to, on Halloween, dress up the way we really want to be, the way we wish we were. Well, why not try and make your life more what you would have preferred, which what you would hope. You know, that can, you know, get a new outfit to the most extreme. If it's what you need to be happy, consider plastic surgery. Whatever it is, the new you, create something new. Like if you've wanted to have a blog or a podcast or something in your life created, the skeleton is not being mopey about being a skeleton and being dead because he's growing a new garden. So whatever it is, if you wanted to, it's like build something, and then you're not going to be caught up in what isn't, you know, and the sad thing, and the part of your life that is unfair, or the part of the queer community that is unfair right now. Create something new.
And it also made me think, I just saw a blog post recently for doing a fall cleaning, like a spring cleaning, and, you know, and that death card to me would say that's the same kind of action to take, that it's time to clear out the old, clear out the clutter, because in order for new things to start to happen, to be able to come in, you have to make the space for it. And so if you don't recognize the things that have lived their life, served their purpose, and are just taking up space and are just dead weight now, then you're not going to find those new things coming in because there's no room for them. So that can be very literal in terms of, you know, this is a month to be clearing out closets, to clear out the garage, to get rid of those things that you keep complaining or sitting around, but then you never do anything with, because you'll find that energetically that just starts to allow new things to begin circulating through. And even while you may still have to put effort into things, you may find either there's less effort or that things start to happen or come in that you've been wanting without any effort or with very little effort, because suddenly there is space for it and the energy gets able to move again. So I would also offer that.
Definitely. And when you clear those things out, just bring in something, even if it's small, to be the new project. Because if we clear things out, often we can fall back into old patterns, you know. But if you have that new thing that you're working on, that can change.
Well, right. Just like if you cleared out some old clothes from the closet, don't just get a new like clear out an old shirt. Don't just get a new shirt of the same kind, but get something new that represents the image you want to start having or what you want to start projecting or something that is reflective of who you are now rather than just the same old thing. And so for me, the card that came up, and I used the same method I used earlier, which was the 666 method. The card that came up is the Five of Swords. Now, I thought, good heavens, what a combination. The Death card and the Five of Swords. You know, one thing that that tells us is that it's not going to be the easiest month or the most pleasant month. And, you know, I think that some of that may have to do with some of the astrology that's going on this month, because it is a little bit of a, well, there are some challenges astrologically. And so I think that Mercury in Scorpio and also we have Mercury retrograde coming up starting October 21st, and then Saturn Uranus square is really kind of activated this month. So there are some challenging aspects energetically that I think are informing how the month will feel. And this combination of cards to me reflects that. So
we're going right into Scorpio, aren't we? Like,
yes, around October 20th. We go into Scorpio, actually. Mercury retrograde is in Scorpio, which is quite challenging.
Yeah.
Which basically brings up all sorts of issues around sex, death, taxes, marriages, divorces, the occult, jointly held funds. Business will probably be challenged during that period. During the retrograde period is actually from October 21st to November 10th. So, you know, it's internally, it's also working through things that we tend to carry a lot of guilt around, kind of the darker emotional states. So that'll probably get stirred up during this month, especially towards the end of the month with the Mercury retrograde in Scorpio. And to what you were saying, we go into Scorpio like on the 20th or 21st or something of October is when we actually enter Scorpio as a sign. And then the whole Uranus-Pluto square is really activated. So we've got that, which is kind of that struggle between control of money and power versus this kind of almost raging demand within us for revolution and change. And so these two cards, again, I think really reflect that this is not the lightest, easiest, or sunniest of months. Mm-hmm. Now, the Five of Swords coming up, when I was thinking about what kind of action items to think about for the month related to this card, one thing that I thought of was to really monitor ourselves so that even when undoubtedly there will probably be conflicts, people's fuses may be a little short, misunderstandings and that kind of thing may lead to issues becoming bigger than they really need to be. Arguments may suddenly flare up more greatly than what they're about really seems to warrant. But even when it feels as if there is conflict or people coming at you from all sides, to me, the Five of Swords says, but you have the choice as to how you engage in that. So you can choose whether to engage or walk away. And sometimes it's better to walk away, even if the other person gets to feel like they won, than it is for everybody to get hurt in a battle of words and people start saying things that they regret and that they probably don't mean, but now it's already been said, so the damage has been done. That's probably the biggest danger with this card, I think, for the month. So really monitor whether it's worth engaging in that conflict or if walking away, collecting your thoughts, taking a breath, revisiting it a different day might be more helpful to the situation than trying to engage in the sword fight in that moment, and then everybody walks away bloody, but nothing is really resolved. I think also this is a card that asks us to be prepared to accept defeat in this month. There may be something that doesn't go our way. We may not get what we want. And sometimes that is just the case. And it is worse to try to get angry about it, to try to get revenge, to try to prove a point, to try to correct the situation, which really means I'm going to make the other person realize I'm right and show them that they're wrong. That, again, can probably be more damaging this month than it is helpful towards any sort of resolution or positive outcome. And so it really is not necessarily worth engaging in that kind of back and forth, that kind of battle or fight. So I would also caution against that. And
Five of Swords is a toughie when you're prescribing action, because of the things seem like the kind of thing you wouldn't tell someone to do, like, well, win at any cost, be an absolute ass if you need to win, or, you know, accept defeat, move on.
Right. Well, I'm taking into account some of the astrology stuff as well as that death card.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Because both of those cards coming up together to me says, let it rest in peace. You know,
absolutely.
Put some death to this. Otherwise, it's going to be the death of you. So I don't know that win at any cost is really what this would indicate this particular month. And one other thing, sometimes I often see the Five of Swords as a card of comparison, and that will be a big trap for people this month. So really watch yourself and make sure you're not doing things, taking actions, or allowing yourself to think in ways that's always comparing yourself to someone or something else, or that you're not always trying to live up to what someone is comparing you to. So, you know, do what you can. Allow that to be enough. Don't think that just because it's not the same as someone or something else that you think you need to compare yourself to, that somehow you're not enough or you're not doing enough or you're not doing it right. Just do what you can, do it in your own way, and allow that to be enough. Because when you start to get into comparison again, you'll start to beat yourself up. You'll start to almost feel bloody from trying to live up to an unrealistic expectation that either you've set for yourself or somebody else has set for yourself. So those would be the action items or the advice that I might give to people is, you know, watch yourself and stay away from comparison. Well, that could help. Don't necessarily feel that you have to engage in the battle. Prepare to accept defeat rather than having to prove that you're right or win at all costs, like you said, especially with that death card, because I think that's going to be much more damaging than it is helpful during this month.
Absolutely.
So, there you are.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, what I with the two of them paired, it definitely speaks to that defeat, accepting defeat, meaning of the five, you know. And I was just thinking about, you're talking about Scorpio, like, Scorpio rules the death card.
Right.
And it traditionally, and I was like, oh man, Scorpio. It helps that my boyfriend's a Scorpio. So,
yeah, good insight into that, eh?
There we go. I just learned to accept defeat. You're right, dear. Excellent. Well, it has been an awesomely spooky show. I'm off to visit Vincent Price's grave, bring him a wreath of black roses or something. So.
Excellent.
One of ours, I'm told.
Oh, well, well.
Him and Edward Gorey. Who knew? The spooky guy
wow.
Were playing for our team.
And I'll just remind people, you can always find us on Facebook. Just look for The Amethyst Oracle. It's facebook.com/TheAmethystOracle. We're happy to hear from you, comments about the show, continue any of the conversations, draw a card based on something we've talked about, tell us what came up for you, and we are always happy to hear from you. So thank you, Charlie, for being here again this evening, and we will look forward to seeing people next month. As always, second Tuesday of each month, 8 p.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. And that means that our next show is going to be on November 12th. So hopefully people will be here. And we will finish off the show with a little Sharon Needles. Call me on the Ouija board.
Love her.
It's just you and me, baby. We're trapped in two different worlds. Now I know you're no downtown boy, I'm no uptown girl neither. We're trapped in two different realms, you see. You wanna talk to me? Well, then drop the phone and pick up the board. I'll be your caravan, I'll be your pentagram. The devil in the black earth. This is not a game, let me spell my name.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows, LIVE for From Beyond with mother-daughter psychics Nadia Shapiro and Barbara Williams, Saturday morning at 10 a.m.